Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as Catholic and Anglican leaders look forward to the next round of their official talks to be held in Hong Kong next May, we find out about progress made at their first meeting at the Monastery of Boze last spring, and celebrating the 40th anniversary of A Hidden Treasure. Theologian and author Father Donald Dorr looks back at the innovative ideas contained in the longest-running Synod of Bishops, which concluded in November 1971. The next meeting of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission will be held in Hong Kong from May 4th to 10th, focusing on the critical questions of ethical decision-making within the two churches. Following informal talks here in Rome on Monday, the co-chairman of the dialogue group, the Catholic Archbishop of Birmingham in the UK, Bernard Longley, and the Anglican Archbishop of New Zealand, David Moxon, said they were optimistic about building on the extremely positive results of the previous meeting, held at the Monastery of Boze in northern Italy last May. That 10-day meeting in Boze marked the start of a new phase of ARCHIC, the third since the official dialogue between Catholics and Anglicans began in the wake of the Second Vatican Council. Unbeknown to the vast majority of people in the pews, these scholarly discussions have produced substantial agreement on many subjects, from Eucharistic theology to ordination, ministry, and Marian devotion. Despite this progress and much practical cooperation between the churches at local level in many countries, public perception continues to portray the leaders of the two communities at loggerheads over issues of papal primacy, the ordination of women, or homosexuality and ministry. But that may be about to change, says Archbishop Moxon, since the Boze meeting provided a new key to help overcome some of these apparently insurmountable obstacles.
It was an unexpected outcome. A very positive breakthrough, I think, using the concept of receptive ecumenism, which we weren't expecting would have the effect it did at the beginning of the meeting. Professor Paul Murray of the University of Durham, a lay Roman Catholic theologian, presented his journal entry on receptive ecumenism, which is a new way of understanding interchurch relationships. And that transformed the meeting, I think, into a new sort of momentum and a new kind of hope, an unlocked door, which we thought had been closed.
I first heard that term receptive ecumenism a couple of years ago, and since then I've heard it bandied about as the answer to all our difficulties in this dialogue. But what exactly does it mean?
Essentially, it means that each church shares with the other what its worst difficulties are, its greatest challenges, its deepest angst, and invites the other church to reflect with it on how to overcome them. And out of that kind of shared solidarity around the massive obstacles and challenges we face respectively, a new sort of intimacy, a new sort of rapport develops, we believe, that will assist the longer-term dogmatic and doctrinal confluence we want. But the formal agenda of ARCHIC 3 from the beginning was the two great questions that we face. How does the global church get represented locally, and what's the relationship between local and global in terms of authority, cohesion, oversight? And secondly, how does the church universal make ethical decisions? So those two topics, which we knew beforehand, are still there, and we've got people working on each of those. But Boze developed a whole lot of tasks, all of which are still at the confidential stage, researching into the background of these three things: receptive ecumenism, a global local ecclesiology, and the making of ethical decisions.
The Monastery of Boze, you say, was particularly conducive, wasn't it, to a very positive outcome of this meeting?
Yes, they've got an ecumenical charism. It's their vocation to be ecumenical. Brother Enzo Bianchi, the prior who founded the Boze community, the end of Vatican II, all his life has tried to host members of different communions and ecclesial communities. And they have huge seminars every year on ecumenical relationships. So when you pray with the monastic community at Boze, you're praying with a group that passionately believe in autonomous sint, that we may all be one. and that papal encyclical On Autonom Sint from Pope John Paul II is their guiding light. And you could feel it when you were there. They were genuine, they were real, they live it. And that helped Archic 3, which, let's face it, had been on hold for over a decade, rise up and walk.
You're dealing, of course, there in Archic with two teams of very deeply committed theologians, of course, but also deeply committed ecumenists. And yet, you know, the public perception persists of these two communities at loggerheads with each other. What on earth can you do, perhaps, to try and help spread this ecumenical enthusiasm to a wider public?
Well, you've put your finger on the pulse. That is exactly what needs to happen next. And there is a group called IARCUM, which is the Anglican vehicle for spreading the good news of what has been achieved so far through DVDs, through books, through publications. And they're about to get organised again. They did do some initial work collating common documents and agreements. They did publish. It has been distributed to the Anglican world. But to most Anglicans, it's a surprise. If you do a kind of helicopter view of what the Archic 1 and Archic 2 processes have achieved, you find that in principle and in essence, we agree on about, roughly speaking, 80% of doctrine. The remaining 20% are significantly problematic for us both, of course. But a great deal of scholarship, a great deal of hope and prayer is going into what next and how we can increase that percentage. But bear in mind as well that we have never disagreed over the notion of degrees of communion. Church as communion means that although we don't break bread together in that Eucharistic communion sense, we do have an increasing sense of degrees of communion. We have a communion which is valid and real and authentic through baptism. That makes us one in a sense. We have a communion which is valid and real in terms of essential agreements on the Eucharist, which is a surprise to many Anglicans. And they've been largely respected by both judiciaries. We have other documents on morals. We have documents on the Church's communion itself, on marriage, on priesthood, which all have had the respect of both churches. Not all of them have been officially adopted yet. But my sense is that what unites us is greater than what divides us. And that's the good news we need to share and act on.
I can recognise very clearly what Archbishop David is speaking about from our more than 10 days in Bose.
Catholic co-chairman Archbishop Bernard Longley shares that sense of optimism following the first round of Archic Phase 3. After 20 years spent in ecumenical work in the UK, he hopes this receptive ecumenism model may just provide the badly needed breakthrough at this international level.
There was a real excitement at Bose that we had begun something in a climate which has not been so propitious towards ecumenical working together. But this has the feel of something which is going to be very important for both our communions. And it is a manageable area, I think. Unlike the previous Archic Commission, Archic 2, which worked together for almost 20 years on a very varied mandate, we've been given something which is manageable, specific, and significant, I think, to the lives of our churches, particularly over these coming 5 or 6 years.
You're talking about this term receptive ecumenism, but can you try and perhaps illustrate to us in practice what it really means?
Well, a little example, which in fact we've been looking at closely within my own context in the United Kingdom. In my own Archdiocese of Birmingham, there are 5 Anglican dioceses. And I've worked quite closely in one of them, the Bishop of Worcester, Bishop John Inge, and we've had a study day recently on the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible. For Roman Catholics, looking at the experience of the Church of England of not only using the vernacular, the scriptures in English, but also using the scriptures in English liturgically, just as we are beginning to use a new translation of the Missal, which is drawing out the scriptural riches of the liturgical prayer, so I think it's good for us to look at the tradition of the Church of England and see, here is a church which has been using the scriptures in English liturgically. What is it we can learn from that experience over 400 years? And of course, we have ourselves benefited more widely within English culture from the presence of the scriptures, knowledge of the scriptures, and scriptural phrases and themes which have embedded themselves within our own language. So that's one small but important example, I think, the presence, the use of scripture in English within and in the vernacular, within another tradition from which we can learn.
You're looking ahead now, aren't you, to the next round of ARCHIC in May in Hong Kong?
Yes, the Anglican Communion will be our host in Hong Kong, where we'll be staying in the Anglican Mission to Seamen, in fact, in that setting. It's significant, I think, because the setting itself is important. It's thinking of the way in which Christianity is developing and growing within the Chinese setting itself. But the agenda for ARCHIC is going to be obviously continuing the work which we began in Bose. And I think in particular, probably looking at some more concrete examples of the church coming to a right moral teaching as communion, local and universal. And from both our traditions, I think we'll want to look at some concrete examples. And we're actually working on which are the areas of church life, what are the examples, what are the sticking points in terms of moral teaching and ethical teaching from which we can learn in this process. And we realise it's only really the beginning when we come together in Hong Kong looking at those concrete examples. I'm not sure how many of those we'll be sharing very publicly before we actually come to our work together, but that's going to be an important stage for us.
You speak very optimistically. You're quite upbeat about this phase of the talks. How do you share this optimism and enthusiasm around these talks with those in the Catholic Church, including perhaps here in the Vatican, who don't see it the way you do?
Well, I think the fact that we work very closely, obviously, our work is both sponsored and is resourced and supported by the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, a body which has just celebrated, just last year, 50 years of its own life and existence and work. And it does have a way of influencing also thinking within other dicasteries, obviously putting before the work of the other dicasteries always the ecumenical question of what is the dimension of this particular work that we can, where we can search for work together, where we can witness together with other Christians. For example, as you know, the Holy Fathers established just a year ago the new Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization. I feel very blessed, in fact, to have been appointed as a member of that council. And I think the ecumenical work that is an important feature of my own experience as a bishop locally, clearly that's something I'd want to bring into my own contribution within that council as we prepare for next year's synod on the new evangelization. I think there'll be a wonderful opportunity within that synod too for, you know, the synod often has ecumenical observers or those who are invited to be part of it. And I think insights, particularly we're here in Rome at the moment, preparing for ARCHIC for next year, but the insights from within the Anglican Communion on the new evangelization are going to be important next year too in the preparation for the synod. So that's, I think, how to translate, how to bring our experience locally of ecumenism into the work of the church universally. But also it is a challenge to bring back something of the enthusiasm that we feel when we gather together universally into our local setting. But I have to say, I mentioned the study day with Bishop John Inge of Worcester. Roman Catholics and Anglicans from right across the county of Worcester came together, 250, for 4 hours together on a Saturday morning in Worcester Cathedral. It was a great experience and showed me that ecumenism is really alive within the shires and counties in England, and the cities too.
You mentioned next year's Synod of Bishops on new evangelization. How else is the Church preparing for this very important meeting? What ideas do you have to bring specifically from the UK context?
Well, two things I can mention in particular. That I think we were delighted that one of our own cities in the UK has been chosen as one of the 11 metropolitan missions. So the city, the Diocese of Liverpool, and Archbishop Pat Kelly is himself very excited about working ecumenically, as well as developing this the challenge which is there to bring the new evangelization to a setting like the city of Liverpool and the parts of Lancashire which his diocese covers. So the Metropolitan Missions is one important dimension of the new Pontifical Council's work. I think the other thing is the way in which we look forward to the Year of Faith. And preparations are already in hand, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council by beginning this Year of Faith. And I think that's going to engage us during the coming year.
Can you give us any practical examples of ways in which it's going to be celebrated?
The Year of Faith itself, well, I think that within dioceses there's an opportunity to focus on the new evangelization, and we're hoping that in the course of the year there will be opportunities for not only for dialogue but reaching out. For example, the Holy Father's idea of the courtyard of the Gentiles. There are many opportunities which we have locally, I think, in the UK to open up a dialogue with people who are interested in what is important, who have values which are not necessarily rooted in faith or in the scriptures, but where there is a commonality, a concern for people, for the well-being of people, and there is a dialogue which we really do need to encourage and open up. And looking at the concerns that there are within our cities, and particularly the economic crisis, which has had such an effect on families, I think there's a wide dialogue, for example, on our support of families and family life, which is of such a concern to Catholics and Christians, but where people of other faiths and indeed people who have no faith basis for their values are concerned about the state of the family and the importance of the family within society more widely. So hopefully we'll have opportunities for opening up our own courtyards of the Gentiles.
My thanks there to Archbishop Bernard Longley of Birmingham in England, the Catholic co-chairman of ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission Dialogue Group. And earlier you heard the Anglican co-chairman, Archbishop David Moxon from New Zealand. In November 1971, the longest synod of bishops ever concluded after more than a month of deliberations on the theme, the ministerial priesthood and justice in the world. After their marathon session, the 210 synod fathers present came up with an 8-point programme for international action, recommending that the church on the local level foster education and ecumenical collaboration, relating the gospel to their work for justice and peace in the world. Running through the concluding document is the theme of liberation, God's plan of liberation from slavery and sin through the death and resurrection of his Son, but also the urgency for local churches to work for liberation from all forms of injustice and oppression.
I think the mainstream liberation theologian people were very concerned for reconciliation, and they were emphasizing the importance of a non-violent, and it was very effective.
Father Donald Dorr is a theologian, author and member of the St. Patrick's Missionary Society. He was here in Rome just recently for a seminar exploring the prophetic nature of that Justice in the World Synod, something which he describes as a hidden treasure of the Church.
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for this. One of them is that it was the only document, as far as I know, certainly the last document that was issued by the Synod of Bishops as such. In all the later synods, the bishops handed over their material to the Pope, who wrote a document perhaps a year later. So this comes from a number of elected bishops, and in that way it has some authority, what you might call a pastoral authority. That's one reason why I like it. The other reason why I think it's important is that at that time there was wonderful cooperation between the Justice and Peace Commission in Rome. They're called now the Council. And there were some very interesting things done at that time. There was an ecumenical side to the work they were doing. It was called Soda Pax. They were working with the World Council of Churches. And there were also a famous English lady called Lady Jackson, Barbara Ward Jackson. And Barbara Ward, she was as a scholar, and she had a big influence. She was the one, I think, that invented the phrase spaceship Earth. So there was quite a strong emphasis on ecology already in 1971, 40 years ago, which was a bit ahead of the field, so to speak.
So a very prophetic document in very many ways. But in terms of this question of participation of the bishops, you see it really as perhaps a model of this subsidiarity that is still a key question for the Church today.
Yes, it's partly that the bishops were talking to each other, but also that they were using the available expertise that was there. As I say, Barbara Ward was an expert on development and ecological issues, and Philip Land was a Jesuit who was a very interesting person, very committed on justice issues and had a lot of pastoral experience. And then there was Juan Alfaro, who was a scripture scholar. And there was a Dominican there from France. They were a big influence on the bishops, but the bishops knew what they wanted to do themselves. So it was an example for me of cooperation. I think the other reason that I liked the document is that it was quite strong on the issue of justice for women. And it suggested that there should be a mixed commission set up in which there would be bishops, of course, and that there would be clergy and there would be lay people, and they would investigate the role of women, not just in society, but in the church. And they recommended this. But one of the reasons this document is hidden is that we've never heard anything about that again.
Why do you think this?
Well, this is a very political issue, and I'm sure there are different views on it. But my own suspicion is that some of the people in Rome felt, well, now this is only an advisory body. There was also a tricky issue, a very technical question, that one of the controversial things that this document said was that the action on behalf of justice is a constitutive part of preaching the gospel. And constitutive in this sense means an essential part. And afterwards, there was a strong movement to call it an integral part. Now, that's very technical. What would be the difference? But the difference would be that, say, my heart is a constitutive part, but my nose is only an integral part. So if I did happen to lose my nose or my ear, I could still survive. So the implication would be that if it's only an integral part, then you could have the preaching of the gospel with little or no reference to justice. So it's controversial in that sense.
Do you see, therefore, that this whole question of justice as an essential part of the church, do you see that that has been played down over the past decades?
That's a very tricky question. Personally, I don't think so. I think that there may be some people who, in quite authoritative roles, who would like to play it down. But I think that the real reaction is against what they would see as liberation theology. So it's not a question of is there justice or is there not in the preaching of the church, but what style and what form is it put. And one of the valuable things, I think, in Pope Benedict's fairly recent encyclical, the one that came out in 2009 called Caritas in Veritate, is that he emphasizes a more positive slant. Now, in my opinion, we need both. We need a quite confrontative slant at times. And Pope John Paul and even Benedict himself has at times confronted governments. But we also need, and this is where I think Pope Benedict is very strong, on getting lay people to develop models of economy that are what he calls an economy of communion. And the economy of communion would be a more human form where human relationships are important, where there's an element of gift, or what he calls gratuitousness. And I think that's a very valuable contribution. So as I say, to answer your question again, it's not a question of whether justice is an important part of the church's preaching, but what style.
Of course, in the days when this document was written in the 1970s, there was a fear, wasn't there, that action for justice perhaps would somehow take the place of the essential questions of faith and worship. Do you think any of those fears were justified?
Again, a very controversial issue. Shortly before this time, around the end of the 60s, there was a development of liberation theology. And it was a radical change of direction. And for some people, that was scary. So when you say there was a fear, There was a fear in some people and there was excitement in other people about it. And I'm sure there was a certain exaggeration in the beginning.
A genuine concern that the gospel would be exploited for political and even military...
Well, certainly that was the accusation. And in North America, the politicians were very scared of this because it looked, for them, there was just a simple choice. Are you for revolution? And remember, this was the time of Cuba and all of that. Or are you for revolution, violent revolution, or are you pacifist, so to speak, or the church? And so it suited them to have only two alternatives. Whereas I think the mainstream liberation theologian people were very concerned for reconciliation and they were emphasizing the importance of a non-violent. And it was very effective in places like Brazil. It wasn't a revolution that changed the situation in Brazil. It was a very slow development of people on the ground challenging the very oppressive military regime that was there. And the church people, people like Cardinal Arns in São Paulo, played a major role. So some of the people that were nominated to replace the more outspoken bishops had a very different orientation, there's no doubt about it.
So we can't say that we've put this chapter behind us, as it were, this conflict between pro-liberation theologians and those who saw it as a disaster for the church.
I think if you try to put a lid on these things from the top, it kind of leaks out at the side or bursts out some way. So I think it's better to face up to these issues. One of the things I like about some of the liberation theologians is that they have really moved on. They're not just concerned about poor in the literal sense. They're concerned about ethnic and racial issues. They're concerned about women's issues. And there was a lot of dialogue went on between, say, the women's movement in North America and the liberation movement in South America, so that the whole issue of liberation is a much broader thing now than it had been. There's also the issue about Asian and African theologians being brought into this. There was an organization called the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, which really made a lot of effort to bring all these together.
And yet one of the things that you're concerned about, aren't you, is what you call a breakdown of trust between theologians and authorities in the church. How serious a problem is this?
In general terms, it's a very serious problem. I mean, we see it in recent examples in North America, but it's all over. When people get polarized like that, there's always faults on both sides. So it would be wrong of me, just because I happen to have a theological background, to be kind of unconditionally on the side of theologians. But if they're brought in as the people, the theologians at the time of this document, Justice in the Church, 40 years ago, then they can experience the pressures that bishops and authorities are under instead of living in an ivory tower. So I would be very critical of theologians that live in ivory towers too and just sound off on what they think. I think that we need to bring the two together very much.
What do you think can be done to try and overcome these polarizations that you're talking about?
If theologians can empower lay people to express what the gospel means to them, that somehow changes their whole attitude. And one would hope that bishops and authorities would be doing the same thing and they would come together in that way, having a common agenda. A good part of the work that I do now is running workshops on spirituality, in which I'm not giving input, but I'm helping people to create an atmosphere where they can share where the Spirit is calling them and moving them. I think that one of the big problems in our church is that we have neglected the whole theology of the Spirit at a very practical level. And maybe if we can all together pray a bit more to the Spirit, we may come together.
My thanks there to theologian and author Father Donald Dorr. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.